Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS LP, Cal's Radio. Broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. Bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cal's Community Radio thanks Minnie Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Minnie Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Minnie Rivers carries fine loose leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Minnie Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. You can reach them by phone at area code 707-829-8871, by email at info@miniriversbooks.com, or on the web at www.miniriversbooks.com. Cal's Community Radio wishes to thank the Occidental Community Council for their generous support. The Occidental Community Council strives to meet the unmet needs of the Occidental area. The council invites you to attend its meetings every third Saturday of the month at 10:30 a.m. at the YMCA Community Center. This is just a reminder that Cal's Community Radio is membership supported, and we are currently in the middle of an Indiegogo fundraising campaign and provides a very simple way for you to become a member. If you go to www.kows.fm, you'll find a link and a bucket that's being filled with goodness, and that link will take you to the Indiegogo site where you can basically contribute to the campaign, and as you contribute, you automatically become a member of the herd. Different membership levels and different premiums are available, but more than the premiums, this is just your way to help us stay on the air, to give your thanks back and your support for the community, to keep this collection of very creative programmers, interviewers, philosophers, and the like, providing original sourced West County programming for the community. So go to www.kows.fm and find out how you can donate today. This week, our guest by phone is Dale Borglum, founder and executive director of the Living Dying Project and co-author of Journey of Awakening. Dale is a pioneer in the conscious dying movement. We'll get started after a short musical break. We'll be listening to Sequenza de Morti, or The Sequence of Death, a track from a CD entitled O Chico Mondo, the Italian Lauda, circa 1400 to 1700. This is performed by the Huelgas Ensemble, led by Paul Van Nevel. And we'll be right back.
Scrivere con le sibille.
Ahimè, che grande errore farà il giudice in furore, giudicando con rigore.
Raccorra l'orribile tromba, tutti morti
Salvame per tuo pietà.
This is the Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick, the Mystical Positivist. I'll be joined later in the studio by my co-host, Rob Schmidt, who's the director of Tayu Meditation Center in Sebastopol and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol. This week, our guest by phone is Dale Borglum, founder and executive director of the Living Dying Project. Dale is a pioneer in the conscious dying movement and has worked directly with thousands of people with life-threatening illness and their families for over 30 years. In 1981, Dale founded the first residential facility for people who wish to die consciously in the United States, the Dying Center. He has taught and lectured extensively on the topics of spiritual support for those with life-threatening illness, on caregiving as a spiritual practice, and on healing at the edge of illness, of death, of loss, of crisis. Dale has a BS from UC Berkeley and a PhD from Stanford University. He is the co-author of Journey of Awakening, a meditator's guidebook, and has taught meditation for the past 35 years after studying practices of devotion, meditation, and contemplative prayer with many of the greatest masters of the last century, including Neem Karoli Baba, Suzuki Roshi, Ananda Mai, Kalu Rinpoche, the 16th Karmapa, Dilgo Khyentse, Mahasi Saida, Sokni Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche, Goenka, Duchem Rinpoche, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Dale has taught with Ram Dass, Stephen Levine, Joan Halifax, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Reverend Wayne Muller, and many others. His life's work and passion has been and continues to be the healing of our individual and collective relationship with death and also our mortality as an inspiration for spiritual awakening. Dale Borglum, welcome to the Mystical Positivist.
Thank you very much for having me.
So our custom with these interviews is usually to begin by asking our guests to describe early religious or spiritual impressions and background. So we'd like you to tell us about any early experiences and impressions that you had that led to the work that you do now, and you know, basically what impressions informed your sense of spirituality.
Well, you mentioned that I had a bachelor's degree and a PhD, but what you didn't mention is that they were in mathematics.
That's great for the show, indeed.
And yet, at the same time, being at Berkeley and Stanford back in the 1960s, that was when the consciousness explosion was exploding. And it became clear to me that even though I was almost done with my PhD, that I didn't really want to be a mathematician for the rest of my life. And as luck or karma would have it, whenever Ram Dass came to Northern California, he would stay right across the street from where I was living in Palo Alto. And we became good friends when I was a graduate student.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it turns out that even though I was really good at math, it wasn't something that was moving my heart at all. And as time went on, I really became less and less happy being a scientist, and was really feeling in some way that I felt like it was almost a mistake that I was put on the planet, that I just couldn't find my place, what it was I was supposed to do. But right after I got my PhD, I went off to India, and at that point met Neem Karoli Baba, Maharaji Ram Dass's guru, as well as some of those other teachers that you mentioned. And it became clear to me that there is another dimension of being that these people were living examples of that was far beyond anything Stanford or Berkeley had ever talked about, and that that was where my freedom resided, and that was the direction my life was going to take.
I'm curious if you found, when you were in that, like, the Berkeley environment, was it that you knew then that there were questions about life or the nature of being that were important to you that you weren't finding answers to, or was it more at a heart level where there was a yearning that you didn't quite know what it was and only began to realize that something else was necessary?
Well, it was actually not so much at Berkeley. I went to Berkeley in the beginning of, I graduated in 1964, and at that point, the free speech movement hadn't happened yet. It was still a pretty straight-laced place, beers and fraternities, that sort of thing. But when I got to Stanford, the Vietnam War had started, the consciousness explosion had started, psychedelic drugs had started, social protests had started, and there were a lot of workshops at Stanford that I helped organize where people came and taught about meditation and bioenergetics and gestalt therapy and psychodrama and all that kind of stuff. So I was raised as a Danish Lutheran. Both of my parents were very religious, loving people. And yet when I got off to college, this whole Lutheran background that I had didn't really make all that much sense in a certain way. I mean, I love Jesus, but the whole outer church thing wasn't really touching my heart at all. But through meditation, through intensive yoga, I really sort of became a yogi, standing on my head for long periods of time and swallowing claws and moving them about my intestines to purify myself, and being a fruitarian for a while, and generally doing all these really extreme things that probably didn't help very much, but at least got me pointed in a direction that I could see that by moving toward this direction that the world's religions had talked about, that I could go beyond these neurotic places that I was really caught. So I went off to India, I came back, and Ram Dass hired me to be the executive director of his nonprofit foundation, the Hanuman Foundation. And after a short amount of time, Stephen Levine joined us, and he started teaching these conscious dying retreats after having worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross for a year or two. So he invited me to be the Buddhist meditation teacher at his retreats, and we taught together for some time, and then eventually Ram Dass, Stephen, and I decided it would be nice to actually have a place in which we could put into practice these ideas that we had only been talking about, and decided mutually that a place we'd all be willing to live was Santa Fe, New Mexico. So in the beginning of the 1980s, we all moved to Santa Fe. Ram Dass got busy doing what he was doing. Stephen met Andre and decided to get married and take care of his wife, who was not too healthy at that point, rather than start this center. So it fell to me to start this place called the Dying Center. And we had this facility right outside of Santa Fe, a big house in the country, where people came who wanted to die consciously. They came, stayed there free of charge. We had a staff to take care of them, and over a course of about 3 years or so, we had 80-some people come. This was a really transformative experience and showed me very deeply that this work with the dying was, first of all, very important work in terms of the individuals that came, but also that collectively America was denying death, and that was really at the bottom, at the heart of ways that our society was, and in fact still is, out of balance. We look around and there's homelessness and hunger and environmental degradation and all kinds of other problems, and we can throw money at those things, but as long as we collectively are pretending that we're not going to die, then you put money over here and the problem pops up over there, and you put some money over there and then the problem pops up a third place, because when we're not knowing we're going to die, it's very difficult to live consciously. And in fact, in Buddhism, they have what are called the four mind-turning truths, where a beginning practitioner contemplates these truths to motivate them to look more clearly at who they are and what's going on, because what's going on is often difficult to look at. And the first of these mind-turning truths is that you will die, but you don't know when. Now, that's something that's obviously rationally obvious. We all know that. But if you and I and the listeners actually in this moment knew that we were going to die and we didn't know when, maybe even before the end of this broadcast, maybe before the end of this next sentence, how would it affect the way that I was talking, you were listening, my heart was opening to you, your heart was opening to me? It would probably deepen our willingness to be fully present, because if you don't know you're going to be around tomorrow, then it brings us to the second of these mind-turning truths, which is that life is precious. And in fact, it is so easy in this postmodern world where we're hooked into the internet and so busy and getting how many emails and texts and phone calls every day, to begin to lose touch with that preciousness, that quality of looking at another human being, looking at nature, hearing a piece of music, or even doing something very mundane like taking a shower or crawling out of bed in the morning. Can you do that in a way where you're really awake, where this is a precious moment?
Right. I'm interested in your perspective on the many of the traditions that have come from the East for meditation and for cultivating that kind of awakeness, all arose in a different kind of culture where perhaps people didn't have many of the factors that people in the West have. I'm curious if you agree or disagree with that perspective, that there's like some of the technology that originally was developed may actually intensify some of the sense of isolation. Like, you know, I think I've read you say that you have, when you first started meditation, for instance, you approached it with a, let's say, kind of a vigor and a, you know, a sense of that you're going to accomplish something that may not be the way that people in the East would approach meditation.
Well, I don't know if it's so much East and West as it is that these technologies that most people are pursuing who are on the spiritual path were developed a long, long time ago, when people were grounded, when they were centered, when they loved their mommy and daddy, when they weren't neurotic. So one of my meditation teacher friends has this great line, you've got to become somebody before you can become nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very fundamental sense, the spiritual journey is the journey of disidentifying with ego structure and identifying with nature of mind or true nature or living spirit or higher power, whatever you want to call that, God, Christ, Buddha. So in each moment, like right now, there's this changing experience. I'm talking, sound is coming and going, you can feel your body, you can, thoughts are probably coming up in your mind, each moment changing. What is it that doesn't change from moment to moment? What is it that is permanent? What is it that is not this changing moment to moment impermanent flow of experience? And that is consciousness. So in a way, what we're talking about is learning to identify with consciousness itself. But if you begin this process from this really neurotic standpoint, where you're ungrounded, where you're not in your body, where you're not down in your belly, for the place from which martial arts are done, then I think it's not too hard to imagine that not too far down the road, when we start this disidentification project, we're going to get into all kinds of trouble, because it's our neurotic self that's running the practice in the first place. And I've been finding, first of all in my own practice, and then with a lot of the people that come to my groups, that it's very useful to go back to the beginning and get in your body, get grounded, get centered, do the things that are even done before practice begins, if you will. And even people, especially myself, who were rather skilled meditators, if they didn't have some of these basic abilities to be present, then meditation can just be an escape from what's difficult about your life. It can be called a spiritual bypass, where you're using spirituality to avoid what's difficult by going off into space or getting so concentrated on one thing that you're not really dealing with relationships, with your relationship with money, with other people. And coming back to the beginning, even in the sense of early childhood developmental stages. So when a child is born, if he or she has a relatively healthy birth, the first thing he or she learns is to be grounded, to begin to trust in the dependent way Mother Earth, physical mother, the child can completely relax. And if that stage goes well enough, then we get to the stage of being centered down in the belly. The Japanese call that the hara, the Chinese, the dantian, the Sufis, the kaf. And if you're really in your belly, if you've gone from this dependent relationship to being independent, autonomous, then that explains how a tiny, frail, elderly martial arts master can defeat the big, huge, hulking person who's way much stronger than he is, because he is down in his belly and letting the energy of the universe flow through him. So when you meet somebody who's really centered, who's in their belly, it is an unmistakable circumstance. But most people, when we meet them, they're kind of off balance. You could give a little push here or a little tap there and they'll fall right over, because they're not down in the base, the foundation of who they are. Now, opening the heart, which is a later developmental stage, really depends on having this solid foundation. So you and I probably know, in fact, we probably are people who at least at times our heart opens wide, or somebody else's heart opens wide, and then 5 minutes later, not so much. The heart closes because the environment doesn't feel safe.
Right.
If we have to depend on the environment to feel safe in order to have our heart open, then the heart's going to be opening and closing, because the environment isn't always safe unless we're this fully autonomous creature who doesn't depend on safety from some outer experience, from some supportive environment, so that you or I could go into the bedside of somebody who's dying, or being stuck in a big traffic jam on the freeway, or whatever the situation might happen to be, and we could be fully present. We could be embodied down in the belly, grounded, centered, and that's the foundation for then opening the heart. and having a heart that stays open, not dependent on circumstance.
So that's what you're describing very eloquently is a fundamental challenge for certainly any Westerner, maybe it's better to say instead of East-West, someone in contemporary sort of consumer society to reach that kind of stability before they embark on spiritual practice, right? Most people tend to come to spiritual practice because they know there's a problem, but they haven't attained to that kind of, you might call it, essential stability before they can begin to even approach the question of transcendence.
Well, I don't know if it's before. I mean, I think for most people it kind of happens simultaneously. That, in fact, my experience is that a lot of people get involved in spiritual practice, and then after a month or a year or a decade or whatever, it starts to feel kind of stale, that not much progress is actually happening, because their neurotic tendencies are creating detours and roadblocks on the path. So then they go back and say, okay, I can feel what's going on here. I need to get grounded. I need to get centered. I need to get in my body. Let's just imagine there are different channels for awakening. There's a somatic channel. There's a mind channel. There's a heart channel. And I have found, for myself at least, that even though I've done all these devotional practices and so much meditation, that for me it's very useful to come back into my body. The mind lies all the time. The body tells the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm talking to you right now, when I'm talking to people who are on the other end of a computer or a radio or whatever it might happen to be, am I busy up in my mind thinking, what am I going to say next? I hope they like me or whatever. Or can I just drop down into my belly, this dark deep, with each out-breath, just drop down, and then allow that to support a heart that keeps opening and becomes more and more vulnerable to those people that I'm in contact with. So that the New York Times did a survey a number of years ago, what are you most afraid of? Number one was speaking in public, and number three was dying, which on the surface of it is kind of amusing, because obviously dying is a lot more crucial than speaking in public. But at the same time, the place where I would be afraid of speaking in public or get nervous or embarrassed or whatever is the place that I'm getting lost and caught in my separateness, and that place is going to be there when I'm dying.
Yeah.
So that all fear is basically fear of death in its various shapes and flavors. That place that would be afraid of speaking in public, or the place that I would like you to like me, or the place I'm afraid I don't have enough money or enough friendship or whatever it might happen to be, that's the place where I'm afraid to die. So I choose to be around dying people, not just because I want to help people, which I love being of service, but because being around others who are dying is the most provocative and awakening thing that I can do. Because if I spend a lot of time with dying people, then that first mind-turning truth I mentioned, that I'm going to die but I don't know when, isn't just some intellectual thing that I believe with my mind, but it begins to seep deeply into who I am and forces me to realize that this moment truly is very precious.
I've found it interesting in experiences I've had with people who are dying, either right before or even after the moment of death, that it's a very different space of being. It's almost like the BS of ordinary life just naturally falls away, and there's a presence there, and both a poignancy, but a very essential human place. It's very powerful, and I get from what you're describing there that actually being around people who are dying gives access to something very vital about living.
the world's religions say that right now we are living in that poignant place of presence. But because we're so identified with body and personality structure, it's so easy to think that I'm over here and you're over there and there's two of us and this is just some ordinary moment on a Saturday afternoon in March of 2013. And all of these contemplative mystical traditions say that enlightenment is present right now. We are enlightened, but we don't realize that. Enlightenment is not finding something new. It's not some big understanding of some glorious truth. It's fully accepting the direct, complete simplicity of this particular moment.
Got it.
And when somebody's dying, if they have the proper background and or the proper support, that which I just said in those last few sentences becomes revealed. And in fact, according to some traditions, particularly Buddhist traditions and some shamanic traditions, that after physical death, during this spiritual dying process, that the time right after physical death is the most auspicious time in a lifetime in which to realize who you truly are. It's the easiest time. It's the most opportune moment to see that we aren't the content of experience. There's a lovely metaphor I like. So suppose I've lost something and I'm in a dark room. So I pick up a flashlight and I'm looking around on the floor and there I spot this thing that I've lost. Now usually we identify with, I'm the guy holding the flashlight. I'm Dale. I'm this Dale thing, this Dale personhood. Or we often also identify with what the flashlight is shining on. Suppose we shine the flashlight on, right now I'm feeling angry. Then you say, I am angry. I'm that object that the flashlight is shining on. But in fact, what these traditions say is that what we are is the flashlight itself, the light that is shining on
the object. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt has now joined us, and we're speaking on the phone with Dale Borglum, founder and executive director of the Living Dying Project and co-author of Journey of Awakening. Dale is a pioneer in the conscious dying movement. So as you're saying, that at the place of just after death, the flashlight, as it were, we focus on the source of the light rather than the object that's being illuminated by the light. Am I understanding that correctly?
What's being said is that one of the first things that happens after you physically die is that you merge into that light. You see that which is true right now, but which is covered over by identification with that which is separate. But right after we die, we merge into the light. Now, according to the Tibetan Buddhists, that light is as bright as 1,000 suns. That's pretty darn bright. And often in spiritual practice, we talk about how can we deal with what's difficult in life? How do we deal with our pain? How can we find compassion for the suffering that we see in our own lives and of those around us? But a parallel spiritual track, and maybe even a more difficult one, is how deeply can we open to the light that we are? How deeply can we open to God, to love? And really, it's two sides of the same coin, that I can't love any more than I am willing to open to suffering, and I can't suffer any more than I can die into love. Is that kind of intuitively obvious?
I would agree with that, although I would say that because it was poetically expressed, it took me a moment to sort of process it, because it's a very deep deep expression. This is Rob, by the way.
Hi, Rob.
Glad to be in the conversation. Thanks.
Sure. So basically what I'm saying here is that one of the first things that happens after you die is you become enlightened. You merge into that light. But if during your lifetime, when you were running around here on the earth, when the light would get too bright, you'd get distracted. It's probably going to be too bright then. So we probably all had the experience of looking to the eyes of someone we love, or being at the beach for the perfect sunset, or being with a child that's so pure and beautiful, or hearing this fantastic piece of music, and our hearts open in love. And then 5 seconds later, we're distracted and thinking about what's for dinner tonight or something like that. And what I'm saying here is that we can practice opening up into that spaciousness, which is the essential quality of love. And I've really spent a lot of time, I guess, trying to figure out why is it that it's so hard to just rest in love, because it feels so good to be there. And really, it is just this identification with ego structure, that dying into love, there's no Dale left. Dying into the spaciousness, dying into that which is light, there's no Dale that remains. And Dale wants to keep hanging around. So Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am," which modern philosophers feel is really not too accurate, probably. But at the same time, the personality kind of believes that. If there's this space where there's just love, then the personality says, wait a minute, how about me? Let's start thinking here so I know that I exist.
Would you say that the quality of that being in love is one in which one's attention is outward, in a sense, or focused on the object of love, whether that object is personified or a more generalized sense of just the presence of one's life? Whereas when we contract inward, you know, when there's kind of a collapse that happens, it tends to be a case that we're now putting our attention on some arising or some sort of psychological state that arises in the ego in reaction to some perceived threat or perceived danger.
Well, love and compassion, let's start over here. Compassion is love in the context of opening to suffering. Loving kindness is just the open heart, and compassion is the open heart when there is suffering in yourself or in somebody else that you're thinking about or relating to. And there are all kinds of very traditional spiritual practices of prayer, chanting, mantras that deepen and cultivate a dualistic sense of I am feeling more love, I am feeling more compassion. However, eventually, love and compassion, the quality of heart, deepens enough that it ceases to be a dualistic process of I am feeling love for you, I am feeling compassion for myself or for somebody else, and one dies into that quality of love. One dies into this ocean of love, and there's no more I left. So that love or compassion can be spelled with a small L or a small C, or eventually it's a capital L or a capital C, because it's really just a true expression of the sacred nature that you or everybody truly is.
Thank you. So it sounds to me like you're saying that there's that when it's not egoically based, it's a presence that is boundaryless, essentially.
Yeah. And in fact, the nature of the compassionate heart, the loving heart, is that it's empty of self, it's spacious, it's warm, it's connected. So if one could do the practice, like even right now, is your heart feeling spacious, or is it contracting around, I'm trying to be a better guest on the radio show, I'm trying to be a better host of the radio show, or can we trust our loving nature and just dive into that and see what comes out?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, because actually that is certainly one of the ways that this show is a practice for me personally. to create a space where our guests can feel that spaciousness that we're striving to provide for the whole context, including our own experience of it and their experience of it and the listener's experience of it as well, so that it's a win-win-win for everyone. And that's definitely a way in which this show itself has been a practice for me. I don't think we've ever articulated it quite that way before. So I appreciate your saying that.
Well, and then beyond that, I think that points directly, Rob, to the spiritual advantage of being around dying people. Because if I'm talking to somebody who's not dying, I can always think, well, I'm going to see them tomorrow or the next day, and if we don't really connect here, if we're not really dying into love, then, you know, well, it's not such a big deal. We can talk about the 49ers, we can talk about the weather or whatever. But if, in fact, I'm with somebody who might not be breathing more than a few hundred or thousand more times or something like that, or even less, then it really focuses one's attention on how alive am I willing to be with this other human being right now? How empty of self, how loving, how deeply can we connect? And because you don't know, I don't know how many more opportunities we're going to have, then now's the time to do it.
Got it. Well, that's actually why I was late to get to this show, because my first cousin's wife, who has had multiple sclerosis for, I think, 2.5 decades, something like that, I am very mindful. I mean, regardless of spiritual practice, I'm mindful of the tenuousness of life when I see her, and this was an opportunity for me to do that at the birthday party of the first birthday party of her first granddaughter. So it was, and she was really present, and her heart was as open as I've ever seen it, if not more so, even in the midst of her considerable physical challenges in her body. So that was a really nice opportunity.
Well, one of my favorite lines is, it may sound a bit glib, but it's pretty much true, that the most beautiful Americans I've ever been around are people who are almost dead.
Yeah.
Well, it is glib, and it's great, and it's true.
Because they're willing to be themselves more than most other people are.
Right. You have to be almost dead in order to be alive in American society.
Well, you don't have to be. And
yeah, exactly.
Can I give a plug for something I'm doing?
Oh, please, absolutely. Please.
Okay, well, on Tuesdays, I facilitate two groups up in Sebastopol, where it was very close to where you guys are.
Mm-hmm.
One in the late afternoon and one in the evening. These groups are called Healing at the Edge.
Mm-hmm.
And the Living Dying Project, which is mostly what I talk about, has a website, livingdying.org. And these groups called Healing at the Edge are talked about in more detail on this website. And for your listeners, even if you're not interested at all in joining these groups, the website has all kinds of information, guided meditations, stuff by me, Joan Halifax, Stephen Levine, stuff about being with dying, working with dying, different kinds of meditations that have nothing to do with dying. And the groups are small groups. The same people come every week. Some people have been in the groups for almost 4 years now, actually, I guess it is. And we meditate together. We support each other. They're very loving, supportive communities, actually. So there's one space in one of the groups and a couple spaces in one of the other groups. If anybody's interested, they could just go to the website.
That's great. I'll just comment that I haven't plumbed the entirety of the depths of the website because, as you were saying, there's a lot of information and really lovely, some really lovely stuff on there for sure. So I will just echo your plug.
Thanks.
We will for sure be having a link to that website on our Mystical Positivist website,
okay.
Which will announce that all out at the end. That's our custom to do, but it doesn't hurt to bring it up right here, right now.
Yeah.
Thank you. So what I was listening as I was driving the last segment up from Morgan Hill, where I was earlier today, and I heard most of what you guys were saying, but there were a couple of little blackout periods where I had to switch from my iPhone to the radio, the car radio, and then when I came back in the studio. And I'm wondering if you have gotten to talk about I heard the discussion about what you were, you're seeking after you'd gotten your PhD going in math, going to India and meeting all these amazing spiritual teachers. But I'm not quite clear on how that translated into the work that you came to do and has, eventually came to be called the Living Dying Project. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I don't know how much we should go over what I said before, but
anything. Don't go over anything you've already said, but just how what it means. I guess the interesting stuff to me is my first exposure to the impact of dying was my spiritual teachers and partners passing, and then that was 6 months after my mother passed away, and then a number of years later, Stuart's father died, and that was a very, because of that experience, those experiences, we were able to help create a context, help the whole family create a context to do that, to help him do that in a way that was really wonderful. And I'm just wondering how you personally, at a feeling level, got nourishment, found the nourishment to create a life's work from that.
Well, that's a good question. I really haven't quite thought of... the nourishment was self-arising, if you will. I mean, I've been a meditator for quite a long time, and as I was mentioning to Stuart before you showed up, that Stephen Levine, shortly after he began teaching, invited me to be the meditation teacher at his retreats.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very difficult to be just the meditation teacher when you're in a room with people who are dying and people who are grieving, people who have critical illnesses, that
mm-hmm.
you become connected with these human beings in a very direct, heartfelt way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you can imagine what 10 years of studying higher mathematics at Berkeley and Stanford did to my mind.
I got my PhD at Berkeley in archaeology, which may be less abstruse, but it has its strengths in that area.
Okay, so anyway, my mind was really a mess by the time I got my PhD. let me just say that.
Okay.
And it was just very, very clear to me that I needed to work on my heart. I had the great grace and good fortune when I was in India to meet a number of those teachers that Stuart so graciously listed in my kind introduction there. And the chief of those was Maharaji Neem Crowley, who I spent 6 or 7 months with in India. And being with somebody who has become love, being with somebody who has gone beyond identification with that which is separate is a transformative experience. So I came back to America from this trip to India. I was there for over a year that first time, feeling I don't want to come back and be a mathematician again. So I came back, and I had a series of jobs. I was a cook in a restaurant. I managed a musical group, different things like that. And eventually, Ram Dass invited me to be the executive director of the Hanuman Foundation. Hanuman is the Hindu deity, the monkey god, who is the embodiment of selfless service.
Strangely, I should point out that I'm looking in the studio at a poster that has Hanuman with his rending his heart open.
Right.
So it's right across from me as you're speaking.
Well, and the reason he's pulling his heart open is because there's a whole story there, the Ramayana, where in various parts of India that's like as popular as the Bible is in certain parts of America. But there's a whole story about Ram being separated from his wife, which is basically the male aspect of God being separated from the female aspect, that form was separated from the impersonal, the absolute, which is the state that most of us live in, that we're lost in form and all of the activity and stuff of the world, and we forget the unmanifest absolute, which is inherently present, even though it takes a certain kind of special looking to actually see. So there's this whole story of the Ramayana where there's bears and talking monkeys and people, animals flying around and things like that. But the basic metaphor is that the male and female aspect of God are only reunited through the activities of Hanuman, of serving God, doing what you're doing. Your activity is done as your spiritual gift, if you will, or your spiritual offering. So the Hanuman helped Ram find Sita, and there was this big, huge party, but Hanuman wasn't there. So somebody went to find Hanuman, and they said, "Hanuman, you should come to the party. Everybody's missing you. Why aren't you with Ram and Sita?" And Hanuman put his hands right into his chest, and he pulled his chest open, and as he ripped it open, there was Ram and Sita. There was God in the center of his heart. He said, "I don't need to go to your party. Ram and Sita are in my heart every moment of my life." So this teacher that I was with in India, his temples were Hanuman temples, and we got familiar with this idea of doing what we were doing as selfless service. And coming back to America, it became clear through the work that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had started doing, and then Stephen, and then Ram Dass and I joining Stephen, were doing, that the place that was most out of balance in America was our collective relationship with death. And that we could take our spiritual knowledge, our spiritual background, and become meditation teachers or yoga teachers or do this or that, but the kind of service that would be most useful collectively and to the individuals that we would then come in touch with was the service of applying these basic spiritual practices to the encounter with life-threatening illness, to bring, in a way, death out of the closet in a certain set, so that people could live in a more open, less fearful way. And another part of the Hanuman Foundation at that point was the Prison Ashram Project, where another guy, Bo Lozov, who recently died, started a program where he was doing the same kind of thing we were doing, but instead of talking to dying people, he was talking to prisoners. He'd go into prisons and say, "Look, you don't want to be here, but here you are, you're stuck in here," and it's kind of like being in an ashram. They're taking care of you, you got a place here where you can meditate and pray, and if you can get over your resentment and your anger and your shame about being here, then you can use this time. And we were saying essentially that same thing to people who were stuck not in a jail cell, but in a body that was dying or was grieving. and saying, look, it, I'm really, really sorry that this is happening in your life, but it is happening, and how can we use this to awaken? How can we use what's going on now to find out more truly, more nakedly, more directly, who you are, who I am?
Did you find that the people who weren't dying but who were serving in this way in support of this work found a very direct access to that awakening through that service?
Everybody who worked at the dying center, and you have to remember this was back in the 1980s, so a dollar wasn't what it is today, but I think we were paying people $200 a month to work there, so plus free room and board. And so
they must have been getting fed in some way other than dollars.
Well, but what they ended up saying, every person that worked there for any period of time said it was the most challenging and yet the most rewarding thing they had ever done in their lives, because there was usually somebody living in the house who was dying. Sometimes there would be a space, somebody died, and the next client hadn't showed up. Sometimes there were multiple clients. But usually there was somebody in the bedroom next to mine who had cancer. In those days, AIDS hadn't really exploded yet. It was just beginning in California when we were closing up the dying center in 1984. So almost all of our patients were cancer patients. So there was usually somebody in the bedroom next to mine who was dying of cancer. And it really forced all of us who were working there to realize that there was no time off. I mean, at any moment, you might be called into that room to change the bedding or to hold somebody's hand or to meditate with somebody. I mean, I remember one night, it was my turn to be on duty, if you will, through the night shift. And there was a person dying. She had colon cancer, which meant that she was losing control over her bowels, and that her feces wasn't just feces, but it was really smelled pretty horrible because of the cancer. And I heard a noise. I came in there, and she had defecated all over the bedding, and she was so close to dying that she was a bit incoherent, actually, and she had gotten her hands in this and was spreading it around. So in the middle of the night, I spent like about an hour and a half changing the bed, bathing her, cleaning the whole thing up.
Mm-hmm.
I kissed her. I said, okay, I'm going back to bed. I lay down, and I was in my bed for about 10 seconds, and I heard a similar noise, and I went in there, and I had to start all over again. Now, at that point, I could have been irritated. I could have you know, say, what am I doing with my life here? What's going on here? But it seemed like, okay, just start cleaning again. And that was my practice. So I'm certainly not saying I was Mother Teresa in drag or anything like that, but a lot of the lessons came up not at some glorious moment right at the moment of death, but in all the weeks and months leading up to that, where there was so many opportunities to be selfless or to say, no, this is not what I really signed up for. And oftentimes dying can be kind of a boring process, interspersed with amazing interruptions of this slow, gradual decline. Maybe somebody's in a coma for weeks and weeks at the end of their life. So it was very, very good training for my mathematically trained mind to let go of thinking it knew all the answers.
That's great. We need to take a short break at the hour. The time is 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, This is KOWS LP, Cal's Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is Stuart Goodnick. In the second hour of our program, co-host Rob Schmidt and I will continue our discussion by phone with Dale Borglum, founder and executive director of the Living Dying Project and co-author of Journey of Awakening. Dale is a pioneer in the conscious dying movement. Cal's Community Radio thanks West County Herb Company for their support. West County Herb Company provides locally grown organic herbs, soaps, lotions, salves, tinctures, and medicine-making supplies. They are located a half block off of a half block north of Howard's Restaurant in downtown Occidental. Cal's Community Radio also gratefully acknowledges the Cloverdale Historical Society for their support. The Cloverdale Historical Society is dedicated to collecting and conserving materials and information that represent Cloverdale area history. This includes the preservation, interpretation, and celebration of local history for public education and enjoyment. Old-time fiddle music is preserved in part through their annual Fiddle Festival, now in its 38th year. The Cloverdale Historical Society can be reached online at www.cloverdalehistory.org. They can also be reached by phone at 707-894-2067. You can also check them out on Facebook. The Sonoma County Bicycle Coalition will be launching its first century bicycle ride with four routes on June 22nd. Registration starts on February 11th, so you have plenty of time, and you can see them at www.bikesonoma.org/century or call them at 707-694-8702. Cal's Community Radio is membership supported, and right now we have an exciting Indiegogo campaign going on as a way to raise money and a simple way for you to become a member of the herd. So go to www.kows.fm and find out the links to go to the Indiegogo campaign. There are premiums associated with different membership levels and a video that you can watch to see some of the personalities associated with the station. We'll return to the show after a short musical break. We'll be listening to Passui in Bono Campagne, The More I Am in Good Company, on a track from the CD entitled O Chico Mondo, the Italian Lauda, circa 1400 to 1700, performed by the Huelgas Ensemble, led by Paul Van Nevel. We'll be right back.